Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Cameron Costa. Today on our podcast, Ford supercharging its EV plans with 4 new factories and 11,000 new jobs, the single largest investment Ford has ever made at one time. CEO Jim Farley.
What you're learning here and seeing from Ford is not just a big investment to scale electric vehicles, but we are creating a local supply chain.
Another software company makes its market debut. CEO of Amplitude, Spencer Skates, on the how and the why of his direct listing.
If I'm a CEO and I'm selling stock, I want to get the best price for that stock out on the open market. Selling a dollar for 50 cents absolutely makes no sense at all.
And one of his backers, Silicon Valley legend Bill Gurley.
All the companies that have chosen the direct listing path, and they've wildly outperformed their IPO peers, which I think is interesting.
Those stories plus Fed presidents stepping down. And we're getting social. On Twitter, more GameStop drama is unfolding, and we've got some Squawk shoutouts of our own.
I saw somebody yesterday saying, you know, what's the price to get mentioned on that show? You know what? It's free, you jerk. I'll mention you for free.
Bullshitsu.
It's Tuesday, September 27th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Congress is running out of some time to prevent a shutdown and a default. Hopefully winter won't come too soon. Yesterday, Senate Republicans blocking a bill that would fund the government to suspend the U.S. debt ceiling. That move leading Democrats scrambling to avoid a possible economic calamity. Lawmakers need to approve government funding before Friday to avoid that shutdown in the U.S. risks default if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling by a point that is likely to come in October. That according to the Treasury Department. What do you think?
I think Republicans are perfectly willing to fund the government, just not tied to the debt ceiling, which the Democrats are perfectly able to raise on their own.
Did you see the vote on that? It was 48-50. So
right.
they wouldn't
they
have gotten it
50,
anyway.
50.
Chuck Schumer actually voted no for a procedural thing, so he could.
It's just procedural.
Back
they can go back and do something they decided on. It's called 304. And they can. McConnell's point is that you need to raise the debt ceiling. You're doing all this stuff on a partisan basis, the $3.5 trillion, the COVID $1.9 trillion, all this other stuff. So raise the debt limit on a partisan basis,
well,
and they can do it.
When I asked that question to Chris Van Hollen.
Yeah.
A Democrat.
Yeah.
Why did he push back? This can't happen through reconciliation?
You can't put it through reconciliation right now. No, the budget resolution doesn't provide for that. And it still begs the question, why would Mitch McConnell block a vote on the debt ceiling through the regular process?
They don't want to do it. They have to tie it to the $3.5 trillion bill if they want to do that.
They want
to push this through on reconciliation. They have to tie it through to that, and they don't have their own party, their own caucus in line on that.
The Democrats raised the debt limit for Trump to do stuff.
Yep.
So now they're saying, we did it for you. You need to do it for us.
Right.
Okay, that's not the way. They don't need to because they.
But what?
Because I don't know. You're going to argue about whether what Trump did was good or bad. The Republicans do not think that we should be spending $5 trillion after we've already spent all this. That's what they're thinking. You want to spend it, go right ahead. But that's what they're saying. And if you want to raise the debt limit to spend it, they go ahead. But they're making a statement. You're doing all this you're not going to get a single Republican vote.
They're making
vote
it
for
more difficult and they're slowing down the $3.5 trillion bill. That's what they're putting pressure on that position of it, using leverage from that. I would be shocked if the two sides didn't find some sort of agreement to default on the debt would be a really big deal.
They'll fund the government. They'll say, we'll do it right now. McConnell introduced a bill. Why are you smiling with that ridiculous snarky smile? They will raise the stopgap. They'll do what they said they would. McConnell introduced something to do stopgap. But we won't.
You know, the one thing I wonder
limit.
With the Republicans.
It's simple. It's really simple. There's nothing ironic or snarky.
Republicans, what they are doing, I understood how they were doing this politically to try and slow things down because they don't have any say when it comes to the $3.5 trillion bill. I wonder if they're being a little too clever, though, because what they're doing at this point is probably providing some unity for the Democrats to say, wait a second, they're going to let us string this up. It did sound to me like yesterday after Nancy Pelosi met with her caucus that there was quite a bit more unity coming out of that meeting than there had been going into that. And that's because they now have a common
reverse.
Enemy.
To get to where they need to be on the infrastructure deal, which they're going to vote on Thursday, the progressives are going to have to vote for it, and they're still saying they're not going to.
Well, it sounds like they had some movement that was moving towards Nancy Pelosi's way on this.
Without the 3.5, because it won't be 3.5. We now know it's going to be, I don't know, 2, maybe 1.5,
we'll see.
Whatever comes out. The two Fed presidents stepping down abruptly yesterday. First, Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren said he would leave his job this Thursday, citing health concerns. That's 9 months earlier than his planned retirement. And then later in the day, Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan said he would step down on October 8th. So like next week or 10 days, whatever. He said the recent focus on his financial disclosure risked becoming a distraction. So he didn't mention health unless he's talking like mental health. Both men were the subject of controversy over stock trades last year at a time when the Fed was conducting trillions of dollars in asset purchases to prop up the markets. And, I mean, if you really wanted to be a stickler, you'd say, well, Jay Powell's staying, and he bought a bunch of muni bonds while the Fed was buying muni bonds, which is, I mean, if you want to hang your hat on that. But
Kaplan looks, look, I don't, we don't know.
Kaplan was talking against this book the entire time.
But I think what you're going to see is that Kaplan was making, you know, $1 million plus investment transactions.
Which is not a lot for him, given his.
May not be a lot for him, but in the grand scheme of the world, I think it's going to attract a lot of attention. A lot of people are going to spend a lot of time trying to understand it all.
And you guys saw the timing on this. I mean, all of this had to happen before Jay Powell went before the Senate today. This is the same thing as the Instagram pause news that came out yesterday. That's because they're getting called before Congress this week, too. And nobody wants to go before Congress and defend some of these positions. Jay Powell has made it very clear that they don't want the reputation of the Fed to suffer.
It is now clearly seen as not adequate to the task of really sustaining the public's trust in us. We need to make changes, and we're going to do that as a consequence of this. This will be a thoroughgoing and comprehensive review. We're going to gather all the facts and look at ways to further tighten our rules and standards.
So all of these moves happen just before Congress is going to get to start asking questions.
Yeah. By the way, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe the Fed is going to stop doing this so we don't have to have these types of conversations, so we can actually trust that there's not
we don't have to have the conversations. I mean, we choose not to have them already by looking at the actual facts of the situation and saying, look, that was all within the guidelines. If they want to change the guidelines, fine. I'm tired of talking about it, so maybe it is
But don't you think the guidelines should be changed? Don't you think that this might actually be considered progress?
And the Fed's actions changed over time.
Like
the idea that they were buying
I don't think any
things.
Of them were using inside info. Looking at what was done, I don't
Do you think the fact that you can own stock, but they can, makes any sense to you whatsoever?
No, and the guidelines are going to change for sure. The Fed's going to
the fact
to
that the Fed the Fed shouldn't be able to buy stock.
I think I have a lot more influence.
You
the
think
Fed,
more,
so
okay.
I understand that that it would. I mean, when you know.
Let me raise one more question with this. Kaplan and Rosengren were two of the more hawkish voices on the Fed. Interesting that just as the Fed
talking
is starting to go to taper, that these voices would be standing down. But if you thought it was going to make a difference and maybe the Fed would act less quickly, you may have to think again just based on Powell's testimony.
It's all a ploy to sell before they start tapering. They're going to say, hey, you guys wanted me out. And then they're going to taper and the market goes down and they get out without anyone pointing fingers at, oh, now you sell before you taper. So you played right into their hand.
Some news for you. Citadel Securities posted its first tweet since January 21st yesterday as the hashtag Ken Griffin lied was trending on Twitter. That hashtag refers to a February hearing in the GameStop saga in which Citadel CEO Ken Griffin said he never requested that Robinhood restrict trading.
Mr. Griffin, you are now recognized for 5 minutes to present your oral testimony.
Citadel Securities played an important role in meeting the needs of retail investors during the week of January 24th. I want to be perfectly clear. We had no role in Robinhood's decision to limit trading in GameStop or any of the other meme stocks. I first learned of Robinhood's trading restrictions only after they were publicly announced.
Citadel's tweets denied claims that Griffin lied in his testimony, saying Citadel Securities did not ask Robinhood or any other firm to restrict or limit its trading activity on January 27th. The company also tweeted that Ken Griffin and Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev have never met or spoken. It's bizarre what's happened on Twitter in this regard, because there is, you know, these sort of, I don't know, we call them memes, where people say these things. They say, he said one thing, but the truth is, if you read the testimony, or not the testimony, but the filings in the lawsuits and the quotes from the emails, it is not clear, and I'm sure the hate will come at me for just saying this, that Citadel was ever asking them to restrict trading. There was a conversation clearly about payment for order flow, and frankly, the fact that there was so much volume at the time that Citadel was likely going to pay them less for the order flow. But that was not a call to say restrict the trading. And it's as if there's some kind of like people can't see or they can't read what's actually
in the
language.
They will postulate things that they want to believe.
I know.
It gets enough retweets and likes to where it has a life of its own, to the point where Citadel said, look, this has exploded into this thing that it has a danger of becoming like factual information when there's not a scintilla of truth in it. I see it with stuff about CNBC. I have never been told to say or do anything about anything based on who sponsors us, based on Big Ben.
I'd like to see somebody try to tell you what to say.
I see, good luck. But I see stuff saying, last week I saw something that said, well, it's apparent that blah, blah, blah. And then it got like, all these, oh, it's clear that that's absolutely true. Oh, of course it's true.
I saw somebody yesterday saying, you know, what's the price to get mentioned on that show?
Because
clearly they're all bought off. And I thought, you know what? It's
total,
free, you jerk. I'll mention you for free. You're an idiot.
It's total bullshitsu. None of it was true. I don't go, you know, I'm not going to address it,
But too late.
They make up stuff. Enough
so,
people like it,
I don't
and it becomes a narrative.
I would just suggest.
I believe Citadel. I believe them.
In this instance,
I'm going to get your.
No, they
your
should
mail.
Read the lawsuit. Look at the lawsuit. Look at what the quotes actually say, and then look at what people seem to believe is being said. It doesn't make sense. But
I'm just torn.
They go online and they have pictures of I interviewed Ken Griffin maybe 10 years ago. I mean, I've interviewed him a bunch of times, but there's a picture of us standing next to each other. And, we both, I think, tried to look nice, like we were being nice to each other in the picture. And, of course, they send that around as if it's, proof of some kind of conspiracy.
I have never been told to say ever to say anything after. And after 30 years, I don't know whether maybe it's coming.
You just come up with all the obnoxious opinions yourself, right?
Right. I have my own that get me in enough trouble. Coming up.
Although I'm just getting my instructions.
Are you getting your instructions? From Ken?
Maybe from Ken.
He's got the hotline.
Let's go.
This might be a good time to remind you to follow us on Twitter. We're at SquawkCNBC. Let us know what you think of the podcast. And speaking of being social, ever wonder who thought up Peloton's leaderboard and high fives? Amplitude CEO Spencer Skates has the origin story.
One of our customers, Peloton, figured out that users who used a social feature during a workout were much more likely to work out.
By the way, I use the high fives and I like it.
Me too, Andrew. Amplitude's direct listing and venture capital legend Bill Gurley on why this is so much better than a traditional IPO. That's all right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration. Our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Breaking earnings, Apple reports after the bell. Will the tech giant meet or beat expectations? Key numbers, shareholder reaction, instant analysis. John Fort, Morgan Brennan, closing bell overtime, 4 Eastern, CNBC.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. Our next story is about a direct listing on the NASDAQ. The company is Amplitude. It's a 9-year-old, very well-funded, $4 billion startup that sells digital optimization software. But you'll hear a proper explanation of that a little bit later. Anyway, what Amplitude does is only part of why we're so interested in this market debut. The other part is Bill Gurley. Now, if you've ever ventured into the Silicon Valley venture capital space, you'll have heard of him. As a general partner at the VC shop Benchmark Capital, Gurley has backed Zillow, Stitch Fix, and, famously, Uber. That last one was a $10 million investment that yielded the firm $8 billion. So, Benchmark is one of Amplitude's many impressive backers, and Bill Gurley also happens to be a very vocal critic of a company's typical exit to the public markets, the IPO. He's been pointing out flaws in the IPO process for years, and when the SEC approved changes to an alternative, the direct listing process back in 2020, he said the move heralded the end of traditional IPOs. Here he is on Closing Bell back then.
I think it would be very hard for anyone to argue whether it's a traditional IPO or a SPAC that that's going to be better than a direct listing with a primary offering. This is so elegant, so efficient. It actually has fewer steps than an IPO. It's wonderful. I do think every single company will move this route.
No surprise, Amplitude isn't going to IPO. It's listing directly, following in the footsteps of Slack, Spotify, Roblox, and others. The flaw in IPOs, as Bill Gurley and plenty of other VC voices have pointed out, is the pricing model. When bankers and institutional investors price a company's first trade, that trade is often too low, meaning it's lower than what the rest of the market is willing to pay for shares of that stock. In the case of companies like Airbnb and DoorDash, which had huge pops on their first days of trading, an off-the-mark IPO pricing from bankers meant missing out on billions of dollars. Here's Bill Gurley again, back in December.
I can't imagine, in my mind, when you can do a primary offering through a direct listing, why any board or CEO or founder would choose to go through this archaic process that has resulted in massive one-day wealth transfers straight from the founders, employees, and investors to the buy side. In 2018, it was $6 billion. In 2019, it was $7 billion. This year, it's going to be over $34 billion in one-day giveaways.
Now, one of the main reasons a company goes public in the first place is to raise capital. And if bankers had priced either of those companies closer to where the stocks closed on their first days of trading, they could have each raised double the amount of cash. Direct listings work a little differently. So before Amplitude's debut, Bill Gurley and Amplitude CEO Spencer Skates joined our TV broadcast to tell us all about it. Here's Andrew.
Spencer, it's nice to see you. Congratulations on this milestone this morning. For those uninitiated in terms of what Amplitude does, why don't you try to explain it and then maybe we can dig in.
Yeah, Amplitude helps companies build data-driven products. We take the same tools that Facebook and Netflix has and bring them to the rest of the market. Today, we have 26 of the Fortune 100, including companies like Twitter, Dropbox, Atlassian, Walmart, and Ford.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we help people understand how people are using their online products, whether it's the mobile apps, the websites, where they're getting stuck, what features they like, what they don't like, what things frustrate them. One of our customers, Peloton, figured out that users who used a social feature during a workout were much more likely to work out subsequently, and they ended up building in new features like high fives and leaderboards to help them engage better in their product and continue to build a workout habit.
I like that. By the way, I use the high fives and I like it. It helps. Hey, Bill, one of the things that's fascinating about this particular transaction and so many has been your commentary online and elsewhere about what's happening in the IPO world and really your push for direct listings and SPACs like this one. Why?
Well, look, I couldn't be more excited that Spencer and his company have chosen to take this path. And as I've mentioned many times before, the legacy IPO process has devolved into this process where huge one-day gains are transferred from the investment banks to their trading clients. And that number is $200 billion over the past 40 years, but $30 billion just last year. So it's actually gotten worse. There's a modern way to do it. You can actually use supply and demand to determine price and allocation. And that's what the direct listing does. That's how every bond is priced. That's how everyone, I think most intelligent people assume markets work. It's just they don't. And so it's so great to see these smart young founders pushing forward to and taking an approach that I think is much better for the company, much better for employees, better for investors, and fits better with the fiduciary duty that we all have on the boards of these companies.
So I just want to go back on that because you said it fits better the fiduciary duty. Do you believe that IPOs
violates fiduciary duty?
What were we going to say?
Violates fiduciary duty?
Yes.
Yeah, I think knowingly heading into a transaction where you're going to take on. So in last year in 2020, the average IPO was underpriced by 50%. If you add in a 7% fee on the investment bank, that's a 57% cost of capital. Find me any professor, any finance professor, where a company that's got the possibility of going public, so it's highly legitimate, should have a 57% cost of capital. I don't think you can find it. So, I think selling your shares in your company at a knowing discount and using things like 30x oversubscribed is nutty. Anyway, back to Spencer and his team, I just couldn't be more excited that a group of young founders is moving in this direction. And Jay Ritter put out some data at the end of August that you guys probably saw, where he analyzed all the companies that have chosen the direct listing path, and they've wildly outperformed their IPO peers, which I think is interesting and highlights the quality of the decision-making of the people that are choosing this path.
Hey, Spencer, we have a lot of viewers, entrepreneurs like you, hoping to do what you've done, but also thinking through some of these issues. I imagine every Wall Street bank in America came knocking on your door saying, do an IPO, and then you got probably every SPAC sponsor in America these days knocking on your door as well, given what's happening right now. How did you make the choice? And was there ever a moment where you thought the IPO route was actually what you should be doing and you had to convince, you didn't have to convince Bill, but others?
Yeah, it did take some work to work with our board and our existing investors to convince them a direct listing was the best path. I think the craziest thing to me is that traditional IPOs underprice companies. Bill mentioned that on average last year, traditional IPOs underprice companies by 50%. And so if I'm a CEO and I'm selling stock, I want to get the best price for that stock out on the open market. Selling a dollar for 50 cents absolutely makes no sense at all. And so that's why the market-based pricing of a direct listing is a much superior path to taking companies public. I actually wrote a founder's letter in our S-1 where I strongly recommended every single CEO looking at taking their company public these days do a direct listing. The traditional path was designed 50 years ago when there was much less information about companies out there, and you really needed bankers to go and sell your stock. These days, a lot of public market investors knew Amplitude before we were out there. We actually did a round right before we went out with a few public market investors, and so just given where things are at today, to Bill's point, it's much better to do a market-based pricing for your stock.
Hey, Bill, before we let you go, what do you make of what's going on in tech right now, valuations? Obviously, there's a lot of anxiety about inflation. You're seeing just in the public markets a bit of a rotation in terms of the valuations and multiples on some of these companies. Put it in perspective for us.
Well, I mean, we've talked about this on the air before, but we've had very, very low interest rates for a very long period of time. When you look at companies like Amplitude, these enterprise SaaS companies that have repeatable revenue and expanding net dollar retention, the investor group gets very excited about taking those revenues and profits way forward into the future. And if your discount rate is tiny because interest rates are low, you end up with these outsized valuations. I think the reason people are talking about inflation, because that's the one thing that people worry could come and spook interest rates and send them north. I don't think we've ever been at this place before. And so it's very hard to predict, what's the Fed going to do? How's that going to affect inflation? How will that come around to these tech stocks?
Fair enough. Bill, Spencer, thank you. Congratulations and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, Ford is taking the supply chain into its own hands. An historic push for electric vehicles and for jobs and for chips with CEO Jim Farley.
This is a really big day for Ford. This is our biggest manufacturing facility in the history of our company. And as you know, we're the number one auto employer in America, so it's a big deal.
We'll be right back.
breaking earnings, Apple reports after the bell. Will the tech giant meet or beat expectations? Key numbers, shareholder reaction, instant analysis. John Fort, Morgan Brennan, closing bell overtime, 4 Eastern, CNBC.
Stand by, Joe. Three,
this is Squawk Pod.
One, his mic, cue.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. On Squawk Box, the most important business show on TV,
yes.
Andrew.
The most important one.
The most important one. You know where I heard that? I heard it on
right
Squawk
here.
Box.
Yep.
We're talking about this.
We're talking more about Carlos Watson and this Ozzy situation.
Did you see it, Beck?
I did. The response that they gave?
No, there's now... examples of
it's awesome.
All of their ads that have these quotes about them.
Well, what they were saying about Amazon Prime.
So many of the quotes, though, come from like paid content ads or other weird things that were basically said by them.
By them. And then it's
attributed to other news organizations as if they said it about the whole thing.
But we digress. I'm Joe Kernan, along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin, on the most important, with the heart and soul of the show.
Yes.
Yours.
We're
going to
run an ad that says that.
Let's talk about shares of Ford this morning. They're higher after the automaker said it's teaming up with battery supplier SK Innovation to invest nearly $11.5 billion in a new U.S. facilities. This investment includes two lithium-ion battery plants in central Kentucky and a 3,600-acre campus in Tennessee. That investment is expected to create nearly 11,000 jobs to produce electric vehicles and batteries. And the latest effort by Ford CEO Jim Farley to increase development and production of electric vehicles. This is a big deal. It's the first time in so long that Ford is actually building a new plant here.
Phil LeBeau joins us now with that very special guest we were talking about, Phil.
Joe, let's bring in Jim Farley, CEO of Ford Motor Company. He is joining us from just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. Blue Oval City, I believe that's where you're at this morning. Jim, you're going to be announcing the commitment that you announced last night, but formally you'll be doing it with the governor of Tennessee. Tell us why this commitment in West Memphis or outside of Memphis, as well as the two new plants in Louisville. Why did you pick those locations?
Well, good morning, Phil. This is a really big day for Ford. This is our biggest manufacturing facility in the history of our company. And as you know, we're the number one auto employer in America, so it's a big deal. We picked the locations because we have three battery plants, and the battery plant locations are very specific. We need affordable energy, we need the environmental approval done, and we need greenfield sites so we don't slow down with any remediation for environmental. The government support, access to skilled labor, these jobs are very different, all of those factors. You know, we need the battery plants really close to the assembly plant. Unlike a powertrain, an ICE powertrain, you can't ship batteries far. They're very heavy, and we want them right near the plant. So that's why we're building such a big site. It's 6 square miles of the assembly plant to build new trucks, and we need the battery plant on site.
Jim, you're also going to have, I know you're working with Redwood Materials, which is battery recycling. You're also going to have, basically, from start to finish, the entire life cycle for the electric vehicle battery on these campuses so that you can say, look, at the end of life, let's recycle it. We have the materials that we can extract from these batteries, the battery cells, put them into new ones. A lot of people here look at that plan and they say, looks good on paper. I'm not sure that it's going to be something that can be executed in reality. What do you say to that?
Well, we disagree. This is something we studied. We have to do this, Phil. You know, look at the chip situation. We have to insource the batteries. We have to learn how to manufacture them in this country. We can no longer import raw materials from halfway around the world, like cobalt. These materials have to come from North America. We scrap in battery manufacturers a lot of batteries. We need to recycle those into the manufacturing process as quickly as possible. And as you said, at the end of life, we have to get those raw materials back into the manufacturing system. I think what you're learning here and seeing from Ford is not just a big investment to scale electric vehicles, a million vehicles worth of batteries in this case, but we are creating a local supply chain that's circular, so we don't have to depend on anyone.
And this kicks in, what, 25 is when we see production at the F-Series, electric F-Series plants just outside of Memphis, and the battery plants come online. So do we see real ramp up in production, let's say 25 through 28 and then into 29?
Well, look, we're ramping up now. We have almost 20 gigawatt hours. The Mach-E and the F-150 are completely sold out. F-150, we're above 150,000 orders now. So we're not waiting for anyone. We're in the market now. It's show, not tell time. And yes, this is going to be a further ramp up of our battery electric volumes. As I said, a million units worth of battery capacity just for Ford. So do the math. You know, we sell about two million vehicles in the United States. This announcement alone is a million vehicles worth of battery. So it's a very large scaling. We're not going to tell everyone what the product is, but we have a whole full F-Series lineup. We're the best-selling vehicle in America. We sell over a million F-Series, and we're going to build lots of new kinds of ground-up battery electric F-Series in this plant.
Jim, you mentioned the chip crisis. Give us some sense of where you guys are right now in terms of when you believe we're going to start to see some improvement in the supply of chips as you move into the fourth quarter.
Well, Phil, you know, Ford was really uniquely disadvantaged in the second quarter. We lost 50% of our production. Our competitors lost much less in the second quarter. That's because of the Renesas Naka 3 facility burned down in March. They're up to speed now. We're improving our shipments to dealers now. Our inventories are growing very fast, actually, at Ford. Our production in the third quarter is markedly better than the second quarter. At Ford, things are getting better. But it's so far short of demand because we have this all new lineup, plus, you know, the Malaysia shortages on chip processing and packaging because of COVID. So, I think it's safe to say that we're going to be short of these key electronic components probably through the end of next year. And we should count on that. The good news is the pricing environment is extremely strong right now. And thankfully, we have a really strong captive. So all those returning lease and finance vehicles, they're worth a lot more than we thought. So that's helping to offset a lot of the production losses.
And Jim, real quick on COVID-19, the vaccination mandate has become a hot button issue with so many corporations. Where is Ford right now, both with your hourly workers as well as with your salaried staff?
Good question. You know, we have populations of Ford that require vaccination, like myself, my whole leadership team, our medical staff, they're all vaccinated. That's required. No questions asked. When it comes to the larger population of Ford, you know, we want people to get vaccinated. And we've invested a lot in education to do that. We're doing a survey right now to find out how many of our employees are vaccinated. We're really excited about the mandate. We'll work with our union partners. It requires collective bargaining in some cases. I saw Ray Curry last night. We talked about it. You know, we'll work through this. But at Ford, you know, we think vaccination is mission critical for the safety of our team.
But it's not mandated as of right now for the UAW workers.
No, that has to be collective bargain. It's part of the process. And as I said, Ray's a new head of the UAW. We're talking about it. We'll work through it. Nothing's more important than the safety. You know, obviously, our playbook, our safety COVID playbook, has worked really well. You know, we have hardly any COVID cases in the company. But, you know, we really do feel like vaccines are the right move. But we have to work through the process.
Hey, Jim, one last question. You're at Blue Oval City. This is going to be a ground up, your first all new final assembly plant since, I think, 1969. Do you expect to see more of these brand new final assembly plants as you build more electric vehicles in the future? Or do you expect that it's going to be a mix of maybe some new ones as well as retrofitting some of your existing battery or your final assembly plants?
It's going to be a mix, no doubt about it. But we're really excited about this brand new because it allows us to be carbon neutral. You know, zero waste landfill, you know, 100% recycling of the water. It's just a great big growth opportunity. You know, what we found so far is 80% of the people buying Mach-Es or have a reservation for F-150 are new to Ford. So these are growth opportunities for the company. In the case of a growth opportunity where you're going after a new market or there's incremental growth, We could build a new facility, but it's going to be mixed. We're going to have to convert a lot of facilities, as we're doing in Oakville and all over the country. What I'm really excited about is the insourcing of these batteries. These are new jobs. There are 11,000 jobs, good jobs for Americans, and that's going to be additive. As we insource, we can offset the efficiency in the assembly area for the job loss for these electric vehicles. And so this is going to be a net gain for the company.
Jim Farley, CEO of the Ford Motor Company, joining us from Blue Oval City, just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. Jim's like a politician today. Jim, have a good day. I know you're with the governor of Tennessee this morning, with the governor of Kentucky this afternoon. A big day with a couple of big announcements. Thank you, Jim, for joining us. Guys, I'm going to send it back to you in the studio. You know, we talk about these EV commitments, and I think sometimes maybe our viewers might look at this and say, yeah, it's another EV investment. This is huge. This is the single largest investment Ford has ever made, announced at one time. That gives you some perspective on just how big this commitment is.
A big commitment with some big jobs numbers riding on it, too.
Yeah.
So that is going to be something to see. You said he's like a politician. That's why politicians want to go where the jobs are with this stuff, too. Phil, thank you. Really interesting.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thank you for tuning in, as always. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, listen and follow Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or even on Twitter. You know where to find us. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
Breaking earnings. Apple reports after the bell. Will the tech giant meet or beat expectations? Key numbers, shareholder reaction, instant analysis. John Fort, Morgan Brennan. Closing bell overtime. 4 Eastern, CNBC.